This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. You may not know the name Kevin Clash, but chances are very good that you know his work. Clash is the puppeteer behind Elmo, the little red monster Muppet from Sesame Street, whom young kids just love. A new documentary called Being Elmo tells the story of how Clash fulfilled his lifelong ambition of being a puppeteer, which wasn't considered the coolest fantasy by his classmates when he was growing up. While Kevin Clash was sewing his own puppets, kids mocked him for playing with dolls. But he kept at it, and by the time he was in high school, he was a puppeteer on local kids' TV shows in his hometown of Baltimore, Maryland. Clash has performed Elmo on Sesame Street since 1984. Let's start with Elmo's song, which later was adapted as the theme for Elmo's World, a segment hosted by Elmo on Sesame Street. The song starts with Elmo at the piano and Big Bird and Snuffy dropping by. Of course, it's Kevin Clash singing as Elmo.
Everybody, Snuffy, Big Bird, come see what Elmo did.
What have you done, Elmo?
Well, Elmo wrote his own song.
Really? What's it called?
Elmo's Song.
Oh, clever title.
Yeah, I wish I'd thought of that.
Well, do Snuffy and Big Bird want to hear it?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Song. La 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 la, la 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 la, Elmo's song.
I like it.
La la la, la 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 la.
To think he wrote this alone.
La la la, la 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 la.
Catchy.
He loves to sing. La 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 la, Elmo's song.
Oh, sing it.
La 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 la, la 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 la, Elmo's song. He wrote the music. He wrote the words.
Great!
Yeah, I wish I had a song.
Yeah, well, Big Bird can hear Elmo's.
How?
Well, just sing Big Bird instead of Elmo.
Great idea.
Here I go. This is the song, la 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 la, Big Bird song.
It works.
La 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 la, la 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 la, Big Bird song. La la la.
Kevin Clash, welcome to Fresh Air. So how would you describe Elmo physically, and how do you describe his personality? To anybody who doesn't, if there's anybody who doesn't know Elmo.
Well, physically, he's a little red monster. He's about 3.5 years old. He has a lot of energy, loves hugs and kisses, and loves to laugh.
So you actually brought Elmo with you, and I should mention you're in a studio in New York at the NPR Bureau in New York, and I'm at our studio in Philadelphia, so we can't see each other. But you.
No.
There's
hi,
Elmo.
Hi, Miss Terry. How are you?
I'm good, Elmo. How are you?
Oh, Elmo's good. Elmo was just in Philadelphia.
Yeah, but he didn't come visit us, did he?
No, Elmo didn't know you then, but Elmo knows you now.
Elmo, how come you always describe yourself as Elmo when you don't say me or I, you say Elmo?
Elmo just was born that way. That's just stuck with Elmo.
Okay. And do you feel bad because you can't hug me and I can't hug you because you're in New York and I'm in Philadelphia?
No, Elmo will be there soon and we can have a play date together.
Okay.
Is that okay, Miss Terry?
Yeah, that's perfect. I do
cool.
Lots of play dates.
Cool.
Now let me get back to Kevin Clash here.
If you must.
Excuse us, Elmo. So you've created a lot of puppets over the years, but Elmo was basically a discard. When you came to the Muppet Studio, it was, several puppeteers had tried to do something with Elmo, and nothing ever really came of it.
Yeah, I actually got Elmo by default.
Tell the story of how you got Elmo.
Well, Brian Mule, who's a wonderful, phenomenal puppeteer, he started performing Elmo. He actually originated Telly Monster and Barkley on Sesame Street. He started performing the character first, and he decided to pursue his acting and writing, so he left the show. And so the character had to go to someone, so Richard Hunt was the next in line. And Norman Stiles, who was the head writer at the time, really did not like what Richard came up with. He just had the character yelling, and it didn't really sound like a kid. And so Richard really didn't you know, need the character. So he threw the little red monster to me, and he told me to come up with a voice, and I came up with a voice.
So how did you figure out what the personality was going to be?
Well, the character was already developed when I actually got the puppet. So I knew that it was a 3.5-year-old, and it loved playing games, and through the games, he would learn things. He always talked in third person. So all of those things I knew. So really, I came in and I really thought about, okay, he's a 3.5-year-old, a little child, and he has a lot of energy. So I thought, okay, this falsetto voice would work for him.
And the whole idea that, like, Elmo really loves to be, like, kissed and hugged, and how did that come up?
I think all of us tend to try to get some type of catchphrase or something that the puppet does that gets you into the character. Like Jim Henson with, hi-oh, Kermit the Frog here. Or say Fozzie saying waka waka, or Miss Piggy saying mwah. The laugh for Elmo was the hook for me to get to where Elmo needed to be. And so that's really how that happened. It was interesting. Lisa Simon, again, the producer at the time, she took me out to lunch and she said, you know, I really think the laugh is really too much. And I was like, okay, I don't know what to do with that because I was so used to it. And again, like I said, it was that little, you know, the connection that I had to perform in a character. And then, of course, the big hoopla about the Tickle Me Elmo doll and everything. So we left it to where Elmo laughs a lot and loves to laugh.
So there's this great story in the movie about how you made one of your puppets from, I think it was like the fur lining of your father's coat.
Oh, yeah.
That must have gone over big in the house. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just got this energy of just, you know, I wanted to make a monkey puppet. And so I saw the lining in my father's coat, and I took it out, and I cut it up, and I made a monkey out of it and realized what I had done afterwards and actually hid after I built the puppet. My dad came home, and he saw the puppet. I put it on his my mom and dad's dresser. And he saw it and asked my mom about it, and he called me and he said, what's his name? And I said, his name is Mondi. And he said, next time, ask. And so, yeah. I mean, they were always very, very supportive of the things I did. I mean, they were very, I mean, they disciplined all of us. I mean, but they were very creative people themselves. So they knew where that was coming from.
In what ways were they creative?
Well, my mom, she sewed a lot, and she taught me how to sew on the Singer sewing machine, and she sewed clothes, her dresses, and also what she would do is she would take some of the material that was left over and she would cover some of her shoes with that same material. So she was very creative in her own way. My father drew a lot. We had pastel colors and paints and stuff that he loved drawing and stuff. So
that's how you learned to sew from your mother.
Oh yeah. Well, I had gotten there was a show called Romper Room that originated in Baltimore at the local station that I was working at, and it was a Romper Room, and Miss Nancy, who was the lady that was the host of it in Baltimore, the producers of the show asked me, could I make a doctor puppet for not only the Baltimore local Romper Room, but all of the different television stations that had their own Romper Room in different cities, and because they wanted to talk about health. And so I designed the puppet, and the character's name was called Doc. And I had to build 35 of them. And they only paid me like $10 a piece. But my mom said, listen, I can't sew all these for you. I have to teach you how to sew. So that's when she taught me how to sew. And I sewed all of myself and built them all myself.
How old are you?
I had to be still in high school.
Wow, they really ripped you off.
Yeah. But you know what? The experience was wonderful. I mean, you know, I was very lucky to get so much experience because that helped me. Jim Henson was very surprised at the amount of experience and things that I knew once I met him and showed him what I could do.
So after doing local TV shows and Captain Kangaroo, how did you get to be a Muppeteer?
Well, I saw a show on PBS called Call It Macaroni, where I saw Kermit Love, who helped create Big Bird and Snuffy, the Snuffleupagus for the show. And I asked my mom, could she find a way of getting in touch with him? Well, she called the PBS station, the local PBS station, and got his number. And she called and left a message, and he called back and said, whenever I was up in New York, come and visit him. Well, that was around the 12th grade, and we were going up for a trip. So I went and talked to him, and he said, listen, this year we already cast for Sesame, but there are some other projects that I have that I'd love for you to be involved in. So I started working with Kermit. And then lo and behold, he asked me to do the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And because they needed more puppeteers, because the classic Muppets, Jim and all of the Muppeteers, were going to be on this other float that was promoting the first Muppet movie. And so that's where I got to meet Jim for the first time, was at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
Oh, sorry, I just lost my train of thought for a second.
That's okay.
Thank you, Elmo. You're so reassuring. It's very, very generous of you to step in and rescue me there. because you've had to crouch so much over the years, like hiding your physical self, Kevin Clash, so that Elmo would be seen while you'd remain invisible, are there parts of your body that hurt a lot?
Oh, yeah. I'm 51 now. So, but, you know, I know that the physically working out is something that's really, really important. So, you know, I sometimes go away from it for months at a time, and then I come back to it because I know that that's the only way I can physically perform these characters. You know, we sit on roll around like ottomans that are very low to the ground with wheels underneath that we roll around the set on. And that's how we get around the set.
Sitting or lying down?
Sitting. So, oof. You know, so we do have to do like, you know, sit-ups and crunches and push-ups and things that, you know, that we keep our bodies in physical shape.
So you're one of the producers of Sesame Street now. What's your title?
Well, I'm a co-executive producer of Elmo's World, and now we actually, you know, Elmo's World is going off and we're actually doing a new format. So I'll be a co-executive producer of that. But also I direct the shows and stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun.
Let me just get this image. So you're on an ottoman hidden beneath the camera performing Elmo while directing?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I block it out. I mean, I have an assistant director to really, once I get out there and I start performing the character, he has to call the shots. You know, I mark the script ups as far as what shots I need and everything. And then the assistant director will call those shots out because I'm down on the floor performing Elmo at the time.
So do you say things like, you know, Cookie Monster, I need more of a smile, or?
Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, if I'm performing Elmo and another character says something, I say, oh, that, you know, that didn't work. Let's start all over again. Yeah, at the same time. But, you know, Jim was that way, too. I mean, Jim was directing and performing at the same time. I'm just, you know, walking in his footsteps.
So before we say goodbye, I want to say, like, I feel like I should talk more to Elmo, but I have no idea what
to
say to him.
It's okay.
Elmo, you don't feel left out of the conversation?
No. Elmo's been talking for years.
Okay.
Years. Elmo would give Mr. Kevin his 15 minutes of fame.
Kevin Clash and Elmo speaking with Terry Gross. You'll find a longer version of their conversation online at freshair.npr.org. The documentary Being Elmo, A Puppeteer's Journey is in select theaters now. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Thank you. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with Trent Reznor. He's best known for the music he's made under the band name Nine Inch Nails. In 1997, Spin magazine named Reznor the most vital person in music, saying that he seems like a visionary, the first rock star to make synthesizers cool for teenage headbangers. In recent years, Trent Reznor has moved into writing music for movies. Last year, he won an Oscar for co-writing the score for The Social Network. The director of that film, David Fincher, asked Reznor and co-composer Atticus Ross to write the score for Fincher's new film, the American adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Before we hear Terry's interview with Trent Reznor, let's listen to a piece of music Reznor co-wrote for a threatening scene in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
It's music Trent Reznor co-composed for the new film, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Trent Reznor, welcome to Fresh Air. This is the second film that you've scored for David Fincher. The first was The Social Network. What's the process like? Do you sit down and watch the film over and over and get the mood in your head before you sit down to write?
No, when I say we, is my partner Atticus Ross and myself, we employed the same methodology, really, on both films, and that was, with this one in particular, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, we started about 14 months ago, and it was right when David Fincher was heading to Sweden to start filming, and we didn't have the script, and we had not seen a frame of footage, but I'd spoken with David at length about kind of what he visualized the shape of the sound to be, and right off the bat he said, I don't want to use an orchestra, I'd like things to sound textural. I want to create the sound of coldness emotionally and also physically.
So let's hear some more music from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And this is, I think of this as having the kind of like a theme for the film. It's not like the theme song or anything, but it's repeated. So on the soundtrack, it's called Hidden in Snow. And that's music that my guest Trent Reznor co-composed for the new American version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. There's something so industrial machine-like about not the keyboard part, but what's going, that kind of whooshing, pulsing thing behind it. What did you use to get that sound?
We wanted to take lots of acoustic instruments, from strings to lots of different bell instruments and prepared piano, which is what's featured in Hidden in Snow quite a bit, and transplant them into a very inorganic setting and kind of dress the set around them with electronics. So you were hearing a lot of live modular synthesizers creating a kind of icy or pulsing bed with something that feels very non-electronic, an organic and an imperfect instrument played imperfectly sitting on top of that, and that's kind of one of the templates we used for this film.
Yeah, prepared piano was when you open up the lid and you kind of stick stuff on the piano string so it doesn't sound like it typically should. What did you prepare it with?
We picked up a bunch of upright pianos for cheap, and then we just started trying things from clothespins to nailing nails into where the strings go, some of it ruining the instrument, some of it just creating imperfections so that you'd have to learn to play certain melodies a certain way because certain keys wouldn't work. Certain notes would ring in funny ways, create interesting interactions between the notes. And it's a very hit-and-miss procedure and also very volatile because you might get something good, but when you the melody you're looking for, the string changes or the clothespin pops off or the item that's sitting on top of the strings buzzing just right isn't there when you go back to that note. It's a frustrating but fun process to go through.
In a way, the kind of sound that you get when you're doing your more kind of industrial soundscape kind of stuff, it's in a way the kind of sound that we're constantly trying to block out because there's constantly like soda machines that are like buzzing in the background or, you know, like some kind of like washing machine that you're trying to tune out or a refrigerator that's vibrating. You know, there's so many like machines that we really try not to pay attention to. Have you ever like focused on those sounds and tried to hear like what's interesting about that?
No, very much so. And I think early on in my career, I was heavily inspired by bands like Throbbing Gristle and Test Department and films of David Lynch, for example, where the soundscape plays a very important role in the listening experience. In Nine Inch Nails' catalog, for example, as early as Downward Spiral, there was a lot of effort and experiments going on, layering in sounds that might bother you under music to create a sense of anxiety. And I've always found that it's an interesting kind of instrument to bring into the mix, creating melody and or purpose out of noise in the various shapes noise can take, whether it could be the hum of a radiator to a room tone that could be compressed and amplified and even tuned in to kind of become something that makes you, that evokes some sort of emotional response.
So have you used, like, found sound in any of your music as opposed to, you know, like, generating it with a synthesizer or some other electronic instrument?
A good portion of what makes up a lot of the melodies in this soundtrack and certainly in recent years, well, pretty much all of my work, is the result of going out in the field and sampling things. And like I said, it could be room tone, it could be a car driving by, it could be walking through a crowd of people with a mic in your pocket and just seeing what comes out of that. And taking that sound, manipulating it sometimes, stretching it or tuning it, and creating a playable instrument out of that. A lot of the melody, the melodic instruments in this record started as violins or cellos and being strummed in a certain way or bowed in a certain way, and then processed and stretched and manipulated into a setting where it may sound harmonically familiar, but if you tune into it, it's not behaving in a way that you're accustomed to that type of sound behaving, the range or the way it's articulated. And I find experimenting around in that is an interesting place to work.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. He won an Oscar for the score he co-composed for the film The Social Network, and now he's co-composed the score for the new American adaptation of the bestseller The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Let's talk about Nine Inch Nails. Let's start with Hurt. Why don't we hear it, and then we can talk about it. And this is from the Nine Inch Nails 1994 album, The Downward Spiral.
Hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. Kill it all away.
That's Nine Inch Nails. My guest is Trent Reznor. So can you talk about, like, the place you were in, you know, mentally when you wrote that song?
Would have been around 93. Nine Inch Nails was born out of Cleveland, Ohio, with me and a friend in a studio working on demos at night. Got a record deal with a small little label, went on tour in a van, and a couple years later found that somehow we touched a nerve, and that first record resonated with a bunch of people, and it felt pretty great. And now the stakes were higher, and I felt a lot of pressure to live up to this newfound expectations from these fans. And I decided to make a kind of conceptual record that told a story of somebody that was kind of futilely trying to fill up this hole in their being with whatever it might be, whether it be sex or drugs, or to try to escape from the sense of emptiness. And I found that that created a framework where I could write these songs that all kind of made sense.
You know, it's funny, what you're describing basically is a movie. Yeah, you know what I mean? A movie or a novel. You have a character, you have a whole story, and you're writing songs for it.
Well, I like the idea of working in an album-sized chunk, you know, and I never looked at Nine Inch Nails as a project that would be a hit-driven, single-based kind of thing. And I wanted to tell a story, and I wanted to be able to kind of explore different avenues in the framework of an hour-long, or however long it is, album-type format.
Don't you think a lot of your listeners have heard songs like Hurt and thought that they were autobiographical? And, you know, maybe it is partly autobiographical. Maybe you're drawing from self-knowledge. But I think a lot of listeners could hear that and think, Trent Reznor, he cut himself.
Well, the terrible irony of the story is that that story came to life, basically, over the next few years. You know, my own life kind of spiraled out of control. And I look back now and see, kind of, you know, I was writing about me. And there's a lot of I's in Nine Inch Nails lyrics, particularly that era. Part of that was just a lack of skill of writing. And part of it was I learned early on that really the only thing I could say that had any integrity or truth to it was truthful things. And the first set of lyrics I wrote for the first songs I ever wrote, which the ones on Pretty Hate Machine, came from private journal entries that I realized were I was writing in lyric form. And when I finally had the courage to kind of marry some of those up with music, and I thought, well, this is very powerful, but I could never play it for anybody, you know, because there's no, I didn't create a character consciously. That character, it was just me, unfiltered. And I realized when I did have the courage to play it for some people that it had a strength to it, a resonance that you could tell. That kind of became the template of what Nine Inch Nails was about.
Trent Reznor speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Trent Reznor. He co-composed the score for the new film adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. In the late 1980s, Trent Reznor started releasing music under the band name Nine Inch Nails. The band was labeled an industrial act, but was more accessible than others in that category. The songs on early Nine Inch Nails albums fused traditional pop structures and melodic hooks with industrial sounds and dark lyrics.
So you say that those songs that you wrote for The Downward Spiral, about somebody who's very self-destructive and, you know, on the verge of suicide, ended up being your story after that album. Did you get really close to that point of seriously considering suicide? And if it's inappropriate to ask, just tell me.
No, I think that I was somebody who was pretty immature emotionally, and when thrust into a situation that was very abnormal of fame and adulation, I wasn't really equipped to deal with it very well. And I think my life goals up to that point were just get a record deal, you know, and I thought maybe if that happened, you'd wake up one day and, wow, everything feels okay now. And as great as it was to see a lot of those dreams be realized, you know, and I can't tell you how great a feeling it is to be a kid that sat in your bedroom writing something that meant a lot to you and then see a year later, be in a city you've never been to, and see someone in the back of a crowded room that showed up to see you sing that song, screaming those words back at you, and it means something to them that's valid. It's filled in some portion of expression for them. That's a pretty cool feeling. But anyway, as the 90s wore on, I realized that, you know, my way of coping became have a drink, and, you know, a drink led to another drink, and things progressed from there, and caught up with me, you know, and the realizing that I am an addict, and it took me a while to realize that, and then it took me a while to take the necessary steps to deal with that, and that was pretty much the 90s for me, you know, the late 90s at least. I wound up in a pretty bad place that I'd hope to never return to.
What did you do to fix yourself?
It was pretty clear what I needed to do was just check myself in somewhere and, for a change, listen, you know, because my strategy of saving myself just clearly wasn't working.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, and he's composing film music now, too. He did the score, and we won an Oscar for co-composing the score for The Social Network, and now he's co-composed the score for the new American adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
And he's a depressing guy.
You're not depressed, and are you? Is depression a big issue for you now?
No, I feel great now. I addressed my issues, and I continue to address them, and I've seen a dramatic change in every aspect of my life. You know, I like myself again. I'm able to have mature relationships. I'm able to be a good friend. I'm a father. And I think that my art has gotten much better. And I enjoy the process of making it now. And I really couldn't ask for more. You know, I feel strangely optimistic about everything.
So let me read you something that New York Times music critic John Pareles wrote about Nine Inch Nails in 1996. Well, it wrote about you. He said, he traffics in transgression, blasphemy, and primal howls of rage and despair, yet there's no anarchy in his music. With Nine Inch Nails, he works himself up within meticulously dramatic, genre-bending arrangements. Every thud and crunch is plotted in detail with melodies, and he turns punk fury into sonic theater. And I think, I mean, that's true in the sense that, I mean, you really are composing. It's not like noisy noise, it's more composed noise.
I'm trying to read if that was an insult or not. I'll have to have a word with that, that man. I mean, I did not grow up in a cosmopolitan environment. I grew up in a little town in the middle of nowhere, pre-internet, pre-college radio. There wasn't even college radio around me. And my input for the first 16, 17 years of my life was AM radio, FM radio, pretty mainstream stuff. You know, Rolling Stone was probably about as edgy as it got. And I think growing up on a solid diet of listening to melodic-based pop music instilled in me that format of hooks and something to grab onto. And as I started writing music and considering how to write music, it would always come back to something that was memorable. I'd try to think in terms of choruses and hooks and melody, even if that was set in a very atonal or noisy environment. And I realized a lot of music I liked at the time was hinting at the same sort of thing.
Like what?
The first Jesus and Mary Chain record that sounded like fuzz on the needle. Like when you put it on, you thought, I don't even know what this is. A couple listens into it. Oh, it's almost Beach Boys-esque pop songs buried under a layer of fuzz that made it feel funny when you listen to it. My Bloody Valentine, another band that behind walls of noise were lots and lots of memorable, interesting melodies, you know, that made you return to it. And I found that compared to some other acts like, say, Einstürzer sein Neubauten or like Skinny Puppy, for example, that was primarily experimental noise, although I liked the sound of it and I liked the attitude and the anger, there was something that I missed. You know, I missed the fact that you couldn't sing along or you couldn't remember. There wasn't some phrase you could chant back for the most part. And I think when I finally got around to writing Nine Inch Nails music, it started to become personal lyrics that felt out of place with contemporaries that were making music that could sound like I did. An emphasis on chorus, things like, you know, pop song kind of structure creeping its way in there. I know at the time, if you would say pop song, that was a bad phrase, you know. But I never felt that way. I've always tried to flirt with accessibility. I think it's easy to make impenetrable music that nobody can get, and you can hide behind that sometimes, you know. I kind of like the idea of subversively working your way into people's heads, and then you can say whatever you want.
Trent Reznor speaking with Terry Gross. Their conversation also included Reznor talking about things like his high school experience and the influence Gene Simmons and the band Kiss had on him. You can hear Terry and Trent Reznor discuss all of that in the longer version of their interview on the Fresh Air website. We wanted to make sure we had time during our show for what has been a Fresh Air Christmas tradition, thanking songwriter Hugh Martin for writing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. But this year, our tradition has a special poignancy. That's because Hugh Martin passed away earlier this year at the age of 96. Martin was on Fresh Air a couple of times. Here he is with Terry Gross from his final Fresh Air interview in 2006.
Now, you once told the story on our show about how you and your late partner, Ralph Blaine, wrote Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Can I ask you to tell it again?
Well, first of all, I feel rather self-serving admitting this, but Ralph didn't really write it, honey. We wrote our song separately, so it's words and music by me.
Oh, well, good. So now you're really able to tell the complete story.
I can really tell the complete story. Ralph was working in one room, and I was working in another on Meet Me in St. Louis, and I played the first 16 bars of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas over and over and over, and got stuck. I couldn't find a bridge for it. And so I just put it aside and decided not to work on it. And Ralph, who had heard it through the walls, came to me the next day and said, whatever happened to that little madrigal-sounding melody that you were playing. And I said, well, I couldn't make it work, Ralph, and so I discarded it. And he said, well, you find it and finish it, because I have a big feeling about it. And so we did find it, and I did finish it. But the original version was so lugubrious that Judy Garland refused to sing it. She said, if I sing that to little Margaret O'Brien, they'll think I'm a monster. So I was young then and kind of arrogant, and I said, well, I'm sorry you don't like it, Judy, but that's the way it is, and I don't really want to write a new lyric. But Tom Drake, who played The Boy Next Door, took me aside and said, Hugh, you've got to finish it. It's really a great song, potentially, and I think you'll be sorry if you don't do it. So I went home and wrote the version that's in the movie.
Now, I should explain that in the 1944 movie musical Meet Me in St. Louis, when Judy Garland sings this, you know, she and her younger sister are very, it's Christmas time, but she and her younger sister are very unhappy because their father's job is taking him from St. Louis to New York, and he's going to move the whole family to New York, and they don't want to go and leave their friends behind. So the younger sister, played by Margaret O'Brien, is crying, and Judy Garland tries to comfort her by singing the song. Now, you said that the first version was lugubrious. What made the lyrics lugubrious?
Well, I'll sing it for you. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. It may be your last. Next year we may all be living in the past. Pretty sad.
But you changed that lyric, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. The one in the movie was, let's see, have yourself a merry little Christmas. Oh, until then we all will be together, if the fates allow. Until then we'll have to muddle through somehow. That was one that was in the movie. Then I got a phone call from Frank Sinatra saying, I'm doing an album called A Jolly Christmas, and I love your song, but it's just not very jolly. Do you think you could jolly it up a little bit for me? So then I wrote the line about, hang a shining star upon the highest bough. And Frank liked that and recorded it. And people, they do, sometimes they do that line, and sometimes they do the muddle through some line somehow.
I like the muddle through one.
I like the muddle through one better, too.
Let me ask you to share with us your favorite Christmas memory, since we all have your song playing in our soundtrack of Christmas.
Well, my favorite Christmas memory was of being 6 or 7 years old and my mother decorating the tree. And she was a very artistic woman, and she did sensational Christmas trees. So it was a real joy every year when she would decorate it. And it was a very wonderful moment. That was my favorite Christmas memory.
And what's Christmas like now?
Oh, do I have to say?
You don't.
I'm really upset by Christmas now. I just hate the Santa Claus and the jingle bells and reindeer and the wrapped packages and the holiday push. I hate all of that. I just loved it when it was, all my life ago, 90 years ago.
You liked it when it was less commercial?
Oh, yes. Didn't you? Well, of course, you're not old enough to remember when it was
yeah, I think it was
so beautiful.
Pretty commercial.
But I loved it when it was old-fashioned. We didn't even have electric lights on our tree. We'd have candles.
We're about to hear a version of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas that you recorded a year ago.
That's
and
right.
Was released earlier this year in a CD that's called Hugh Sings Martin.
Right.
And this features recordings that you've made, you know, throughout your career, particularly like in the 40s and 50s.
That's right.
But it has this new recording from a year ago. You made this recording when you were 90?
I was 90 years old. I don't know how I got through it.
and you're at the piano playing and singing. It's quite beautiful. Do you want to say anything about making this recording before we hear it?
Well, I just want to say, Terry, that I never would have continued singing at all if it hadn't been for you, because you did an interview with Ralph and me in 1989, I think it was, when Meet Me in St. Louis opened on Broadway. And you played a little recording of me singing the trolley song. And I was just about to stop singing because I wasn't getting all that much encouragement. But when, at the end of the cut, you said, ooh, I like your singing. I like it a lot. And that thrilled me so that I kept on singing.
Well, it thrills me to hear you say that, and I still really like your singing.
Thank you.
And I want to wish you a Merry Christmas, and I want to thank you for writing such a great Christmas song. Some of those Christmas songs tend to wear thin.
Well, God really
your
blessed
song
me.
Is so enduring. It's just one of the most beautiful and moving, I think, of all the Christmas songs. So thank you so much, and thank you for talking with us again.
Thank you deeply for saying that. Bye-bye.
Here we are, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who were dear to us, gather near to us once more.
Hugh Martin died earlier this year. He was 96.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. The Yuletide gay. Next year all our troubles will be miles away. Once again, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Kevin Griffin. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.